You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
So I'm a little sleepy, Matt. I'm in the middle of a big piece I'm running for Politico on Bernie's foreign policy. I can't talk about it yet, but I'm doing a deep dive. More about Bernie's foreign policy than you ever thought you could know, but it's making me a little bedraggled. So if I'm not as sharp or as pretty as I normally am, that is why.
Tell the truth, Bill. You're on another bender.
This is what qualifies as benders stuck for me. Stay up till 2 a.m. trying to piece together various injury transcripts into something resembling a coherent narrative.
Bill, you look like you just came from a Shooter Jennings concert.
This is the problem with reporting, man. I'm doing reporting now. Reporting means talking to other people. And you've done some reported columns and some of your personal
columns.
You know,
I got into this business specifically to avoid that kind of thing. Come on.
The problem with reporting, Matt, is you have all these wonderful conversations with people. They give you all these great insights. But then you got to cut and paste the quotes so they fit into your piece, and no one can be kind enough to just say things in the exact perfect way you want them to say. You know, you can't cut and paste, you know, a 6-sentence paragraph. You want a tight sentence, and they just don't
tell me about
give it to
it.
You.
Don't tell me about it. Like, that's how, remember my my piece a couple years ago where I concluded that Republicans couldn't repeal Obamacare and they had no plan?
Right.
I was actually going to conservative healthcare experts and begging them, like, okay, but here's the paragraph I need, and this is how we're going to do it. You know, explain to me how this is going to work. I wanted to write this story, and nobody would give me the
Well, you're spoofing them. I wasn't even being that smart. I can't think ahead that much. I don't have the whole column mapped out, and I'm just trying to find the quote to plug into it. I'm doing all the interviews first, then trying to piece it all together. I mean, I have a rough idea of what
premise,
I want.
My premise was that conservatives are going to repeal and replace Obamacare, and this is the smart conservative. This is what they should be doing. This is what the smart conservative alternative should look like. And so I started interviewing experts with that in mind. I had the narrative. But in fairness to me, I clearly wasn't stuck on my narrative. Like, I was willing to change it once the facts led me to conclude that they did not in fact have a solution that was workable.
Let's get back to the present. As I'm working on my piece, you know, I have a tendency to procrastinate, and I go on the New York Times website. I look in the sidebar with their column headlines. I think it's Ross Douthat has a column about the debate over David Frenchism on the right. I'm like, what is the right doing? Why, there's a lot going on in the world. Why is there a debate about one guy, the National Review still, David French?
Yeah.
Why are
we
debating one guy's view on the National Review, like the guy who flirted with running for president in 2016 and didn't do it? I want to procrastinate, but I don't have the time for this. So I'm going to come to you, Matt.
Well,
what's going on the right where this is like the hot topic of discussion?
Well, in fairness, this is a surrogate battle over Donald Trump and over this. It's really the same schism that I wrote about in Too Dumb to Fail, which is some people believe that you have to fight fire with fire and that the culture, the left, is so radical that we can no longer take them on within the bounds of liberal democracy as we know it. And other people say, well, that's not exactly true. We can do it. Like, we have a system, and conservatives should fight, but do so in a civil manner. And the funny thing is the radicals who are, you know, basically say the ends justify the means are now very frequently pointing to the Brett Kavanaugh case as sort of their red pill moment, where they realized that weak conservatism, David French conservatism, wasn't enough. The irony, of course, is that Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed through the process. So anyway, this is a larger debate. But what happened is, so Sohrab Ahmari, who was on my podcast a couple months ago about his very good memoir, which documented his life from coming from Iran, then becoming a Nietzschean, then becoming a Marxist, then becoming a postmodernist, then becoming now a devout Catholic. And I feel like there's some zealotry of the convert thing going on here. A year and a half ago, Sohrab Ahmari was fighting against illiberalism and was preaching a completely different message. But he's been writing also at this Catholic website called First Things, and they've basically taken up this Trumpian ethos of fighting fire with fire. And they've been trying to sort of advance this idea, and it hasn't really worked in the abstract. And so Ahmari saw this thing, which was something like a drag queen reading hour at a public library in Sacramento or something. Like, somehow that radicalized him. To say, like, the culture wars, we're losing them, we have to do whatever it takes. And he picked David French, I think sort of randomly, as the avatar of effete elite conservatism, and wrote a scathing takedown, basically calling David French a pussy. I mean, no, the irony here is that David French actually served in Iraq, and as an attorney has fought for religious liberty and won cases. So it's just a very weird story. I don't know. I assume it's going to sort of go away, but not really, because this fight between Sohrab Ahmariism and David Frenchism is actually sort of a surrogate war of this larger fight over Trump and conservatism.
So you understand how insane that all sounds.
Not when you're enmeshed in it, Bill. Not when you're enmeshed in it.
That somehow in the age of Trump, that there could be a fight over how that the left is so out of bounds that we humble meek folks on the right have no choice but to take up, you know, our fiercest weapons and fight the Sacramento Public Library drag queen storytellers.
Look, I will grant you the Sacramento Public Library thing is a very weird, it's like the street vendor who set himself on fire during the Green Revolution. Like, it's weird that the Sacramento Public Library is the spark that set off Sohrab Ahmariism. But having said that, I am sympathetic to the conservative cause. I mean, conservatives are trying to defend, in many ways, the status quo. And basically fighting this defensive war. And the left is always pushing a new agenda. You know, first gay marriage isn't good enough. Now you got to bake the cake, but that's not good enough. But now there has to be trans rights. You know, and so I think conservatives feel under attack. They're worried about being deplatformed. They're worried about being doxxed. They're worried about all sorts of things. Basically being purged, not being fired from Google because of their beliefs, whatever it may be. Right. And the Brett Kavanaugh thing is, you know, even though I would argue I would argue that Brett Kavanaugh is like evidence that the system still works.
Well,
because
this is
another
question. I mean, you tick off all these things that feed the right's politics of grievance when they've won the presidency. They've shifted the direction of the Supreme Court, and yet they still hold on to that grievance. To what extent is that genuine? That there's an organic, constant sense of persecution that drives them, or to what extent is this obvious disingenuous bullshit that they know full well they're on a good run and they just need to feed their base something to keep their juices flowing?
Well, I think a couple things. One, the fact that Trump won is actually evidence for their case. It's like, we finally won because we got tough, because we had a guy who didn't play the game, who was a disruptor, who was a fighter. And so that's the model. Now, you ask the question, like, is this sincere? Yes. I think that both – part of what makes our politics today so nasty, to use a word, is that both sides believe they're losing. And both and so – but I think most conservatives, and not just crazy ones, not just paranoid ones, but I think conservatives do have a sense – that they are losing the culture. And the fact that Donald Trump got elected, the fact that the Supreme Court, like, politics is downstream from culture. We have lost the culture. We have lost academia. We have lost the entertainment world. We have lost, you know, basically the Hollywood.
Well, isn't the Trump case a counterexample to that? I mean, the culture is certainly increasingly secular and liberal and diverse and multicultural, it's simply about acceptance and tolerance. It's tied into a greater understanding of certain things, that that homosexuality is not a choice, that being transgender is not a choice, that these are things that have scientific bases that manifest at an extraordinarily young age. And so that informs our understanding of how we should handle the diversity in our society. All that is happening while we're experiencing a political backlash to that. So it's not, the culture has not driven our politics in a linear way, in a backlash way. The politics has gone the opposite direction of the culture, at least for this current period of time.
Well, look, I mean, I think there's a fear that this is like a last gasp. I think there's a fear that demographics are changing and that eventually it doesn't matter if there is a backlash, because there just won't be enough numbers of conservative Americans that are able to that really matter electorally, especially if there are things like packing the courts that some Democrats want to do, especially if there are things like getting rid of the Electoral College that some Democrats want to do.
They literally can't do.
There's also, I think, a sense that the left wants to, the left isn't happy with just equality, but they want coercion. They want to force you to use certain pronouns and not use others. They want to force you to bake a cake. I think there's also a sense that the left is very vicious in political attacks, even on the most ironic mainstream people. Mitt Romney, the binders full of women stuff, the stories about him holding people down and giving them haircuts.
I don't want us to go over a lot of old ground, but I mean, obviously, there is partisan rhetoric throughout the entirety of the history of our country. And it seems highly ludicrous to say, how dare you say something mean, maybe even slightly exaggerated about Mitt Romney? Us morally pure conservatives have been trying to discuss issues in the most reasonable ways, and you offend us with your attacks on Mitt Romney? How dare you, good sir? How dare you? I mean, come on. We've lived in a Fox News Rush Limbaugh era for 3 decades now, and we know the right has always played hardball.
I think that there's been a real shift since that 2012 election, and it led to Donald Trump's nomination and subsequent election. And so, but it, you know, we can argue about the merits of this, but I'm just telling you the perception from the right. And part of this is based on, so I've interviewed Michael Malice twice in the past month. He has a new book out called The New Right. And then I've been reading and following the Sohrab Ahmari versus David French argument. And as much as I'm probably more in the David French camp, ideologically or sort of even tactically, strategically, I think that the Sohrab Ahmari side is winning in terms of the energy, the passion, and the numbers of people on their side.
If I can segue into the Democratic race, if it's not obvious, you know, this parallel debate's happening on the left already. You know, whether Democrats should fight fire with fire, whether they should not be hemmed in by norms and Democratic traditions and proper procedures and such, and also ideology, just how far left should they go? I mean, is there a value in hewing to the center, or should we just be doubling down on our most maximalist positions to fire up the base and win in a polarized time? Biden, people on the left have been knocking Biden because there was a Reuters article, I think 3 weeks ago, where one of his climate advisors, Heather Ziegel, if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, said that he was developing, that we understand that unless we achieve a middle ground, we can't get anything done. She used the phrase middle ground. I'm not literally quoting her perfectly beyond that. So he hadn't put out his actual plan yet. It's an advisor making a comment about the political orientation of the eventual plan. The left seizes on that phrase, middle ground. And as soon as they do, there's a campaign spokesman says, you know, that's not a correct characterization of what the plan's going to be. The left ignores that walk back. They've been hammering middle ground for weeks. And then at the California Democratic Convention, Bernie gives an extended speech where he says there can't be any middle ground negotiating with Trump. There can't be any middle ground on abortion. There can't be any middle ground on saving the planet, dot, dot, dot. I mean, it's a massive extrapolation of what one advisor said that the campaign didn't even embrace. No middle ground starts to trend on Twitter.
Biden should say it's not middle ground, it's higher ground.
That's a nice turn of phrase. But he comes out with a climate plan this week, which it was a robust climate plan. It's a zero net emissions by 2050. He says he's for a price in carbon. There's a number of other components in there, and it's getting and the Sunrise Movement, which was the folks behind Green New Deal. Say nice things about the plan now, which is, I find a little surprising. I mean, the spokesperson for Sunrise said, you know, Biden said he was for middle ground. Now he comes out with this. The pressure worked. This proves that we have the whip hand. I saw a lot of headlines that suggest this shows how far left the party is moving, that even the moderate Biden's coming out of this really robust climate plan. Now, I personally find that there are elements of the plan. Look, I'm not trying to criticize the plan. I'm just trying to analyze it objectively. The Green New Deal proponents are trying to say we have the zero net emissions in 12 years, which would be essentially 2030. Biden saying 2050, as was Beto, I should add. You know, Biden's not an outlier here. There's a lot of folks that say 2030 would be lovely, but just isn't realistic. So, Biden's not alone in that space. He includes, carbon capture and sequestration in his plan, which essentially says we're not going to eliminate coal. We want to capture the coal emissions so the coal industry can still stay without polluting the atmosphere. A lot of folks on the left say that is extraordinarily costly technology that may not even work in practice and certainly is unnecessary. So that's something that doesn't put him on the farthest left of the debate. And he said that Congress should pass a law to this end by 2025, which is basically saying, I don't expect this is going to happen in my first term. This is going to take a few years. It's going to be a second term priority. So he's not on a break. I mean, maybe there's other things he would do executively before then. But there's still elements of Biden's moderation in this plan. And yet it's being interpreted by a lot of corners as evidence of how far left the party is moving, which I think Biden is still indicating that he's trying to operate in a space of political realism while acknowledging this is an enormous problem that requires a big solution. So I don't think he's being milquetoast here, but he's also not being maximalist either. And so this is going to be part of the ongoing debate within the Democratic Party and the left is how far the party should go.
Well, it is interesting, and I wonder, I mean, if Joe Biden is the nominee, then you know, getting sort of so far down the road here, but if Biden is the nominee and loses, there'll be a real argument that they should have gone with someone more, you know, more exciting and, farther to the left.
There's already a narrative on the left that Obama was too nice to Republicans and was naive about it. Hillary was too close to corporations and too technocratic. And you did it a third time with Biden, who ran explicitly on bipartisanship. The worst of the bunch. This does not work. We have to go hard left. I mean, I think the left would absolutely have the hot hand in that circumstance. But to go back to this notion that already the left is so unhinged, we have to fight fire with fire. Biden has the hot hand now. I mean, Democrats won the House with people running on pragmatism and ending Washington dysfunction, not on a far left agenda. Yeah. Biden has a clear lead in this race, and hitting him from the left so far hasn't worked. Polls show that 2/3 of Democrats want a politician that compromises, not one that sticks to his or her positions all the time. So this notion that, I mean, sure, you can find the Sacramento drag queen if you want to.
But the rest of the party
clearly is not there right now.
Yeah, no, I agree. But I think that the, you know, what we've seen from, reporting and polling and stuff is that the Democratic electorate is more moderate than people think based on Twitter, woke Twitter, that the Democratic electorate is much more moderate. And I don't dispute that. And I think the fact that Joe Biden is so far ahead right now is a good sign about moderation. But that is actually almost irrelevant to the discussion about the right and the perception of the left on the right, which is that it's not about the numbers of Americans out there. It is about the fact that there are, and I think the internet has really expedited this, and Twitter specifically, that there is a cancel culture, that there is basically, it's the fact that there are people who are in positions of power, cultural power, at colleges, in media outlets, left wing or even mainstream media outlets, and the commanding heights of the entertainment world, and on Twitter, who have this enormous sway and power over the culture. And I think that, that you could argue that I think in the Democratic Party, it's a mistake to overread that and to say that represents the Democratic electorate. I don't think it does, but I do think that it's very powerful in terms of driving the culture.
Well, this is also, to repeat myself, disingenuous bullshit. The right has been going after, has been trying to terminate the careers of people on the left for a long time. They have targeted professors that they say are too radical. Post 9/11, they went after the Dixie Chicks. They went after Bill Maher. I mean, the Dixie Chicks' career was temporarily derailed. They did lose radio airplay on country radio. Bill Maher was fired from ABC. And this was led by the Bush White House. It's not just like a bunch of random bloggers. This is from the top, putting the pressure on anyone who dared say something that was considered properly patriotic at the time. I'll take a personal story. As I think folks might recall, the hardcore longtime fans of the show, I went to Oberlin College. I wrote for a newspaper where Michelle Malkin was my editor in chief. It was not a publication that was 100% conservative. It was a publication that allowed for all viewpoints, but for Oberlin, that made it the most conservative paper on campus. And Michelle, it was founded by Michelle's now husband, and he had gotten funding from what was called the Collegian Network at the time, which was it's not called that anymore. I think it's morphed into other things. But it was a Washington-based operation to fund conservative newspapers on college campuses across the country. I went to a small conference of the Midwest papers in this network, and we were encouraged to go through the backgrounds of professors and find out they had ties to radical 60s organizations like the Weather Underground to expose them and get them fired. So, should conservatives not be allowed to speak on college campuses as a general matter? Of course not. People should have freedom of speech. But the notion that the right is somehow pure, they wouldn't cancel anybody. They've never gone after a media, a TV show, a movie, a professor, a speaker, a writer. That's total nonsense. Both sides go after people who violate their sensibilities and do boycotts and all that kind of thing. And so the notion that, oh, the left is doing it too. Oh my God, the culture has gotten away from us. We need to go into DEFCON 5 mode. I mean, that's nonsense.
No, I think you're clearly right about the fact that the hypocrisy and all that, both siderism. But I think that it's asymmetric warfare. I mean, the left controls. I mean, so, yesterday I had dinner. So just yesterday, like, I have American Airlines is where I have all my points. I'm looking at their app, rainbow flag. Go to the Four Seasons in Washington, D.C. for dinner, bourbon steak, flying a rainbow flag out front. Of course, I go in and I still use American Airlines. Like, I really don't care. But if you're, a social conservative from the Midwest, this is like woke capitalism. These companies are basically taking political stance. I think it's happening increasingly. And
they're capitalists. I mean, if you are a capitalist and you believe in making money and you recognize, hey, we live in a society where gays are accepted and spend money, and people who are accepting of that want to see those sorts of values, we're going to display those values. That's hardly evidence of intolerance.
No, but my point is that's evidence that that what 10 years ago would have been seen. This goes back to the Sarah Bamari argument, by the way. But it's something that 10 years ago would have been seen as a controversial political statement has really become not just mainstream, not just tolerable, not just acceptable, but actually profitable. And so, essentially, my point is that Republicans and conservatives may be winning some elections. They may have Donald Trump in the White House, but the culture has definitely moved left, especially on some social issues. And I think that there is a very real sense amongst a lot of conservatives that their values are under attack.
Well,
and that they've lost.
Too freaking bad. Go live in an enclave with like-minded people and mind your own business.
But here's the problem, right? Once you've lost that battle, then it becomes – it's no longer the case that you could just be like, oh, he has a different opinion about this than I do. It's no – like, he's a bad person. He is no longer acceptable. I think there's a sense amongst a lot of conservatives, their values, their ideas, they're not just different. They're not just tolerated, but they're now pariahs, and they're in danger of being purged. And look what happened to, there's the Chick-fil-A story. There's the guy who worked at Google story who put out the manifesto or whatever.
If you're going to go out and say that based on my interpretation of the Bible, that if you're gay, you're a sinner and you're going to go to hell, and then someone responds saying, hey, you are treating individual people so badly that many of them are killing themselves, you're a bad person for doing that, don't be so offended. You were out there saying other people are sinners. So
right,
guess
but
what?
If you can't
you're,
get
you're gonna get some blowback to that.
If you can't get, I just saw a story just the other day. There's a guy working, African American guy working at a Holiday Inn Express. Did you see this story, Bill?
No.
Someone calls him up and wants to book a reservation, and he's like, "Sorry, you have to do it online." This person started using the N-word, which is of course horrible. Later, this person comes into the Holiday Express and tries to check in, and he starts videotaping them. And they are this is a woman. She's attacking him using the N-word. He puts this tweet out, and it goes viral. So God knows what's going to happen to this woman. But then Twitter turns on him, the African-American victim here who was working at Holiday Express, and digs up tweets that he sent in the past where he was transphobic. I'm not sure what the details are, but that's basically the accusation. And so we just have this world now, and I think it's because of Twitter, where people are outing other people. It's kind of dangerous.
Well, I mean, there are examples where people have, you know, said a tweet that was misinterpreted and the person loses their job. You know, I mean, there are certainly examples where this kind of call-out culture goes very awry and has serious consequences. So I'm not saying that every aspect of our brave new world in social media is a positive. But to interpret that and say, therefore, the left is uniquely out of control, and therefore we have to elect the most insane person possible and destabilize the entire world because of it. That's not using the proper tool to deal with these complicated issues about how social media is affecting our lives.
Well, Bill, I would have liked to have seen the test case, which is, I'm still not convinced that conservatives can't succeed by virtue of doing things correctly. Now, Ronald Reagan managed to win the presidency in an era where there was a complete liberal media monopoly. Three TV channels, no Fox News, no Rush Limbaugh, no blogs, and Reagan gets elected twice, wins 49 states in 1984. Reagan gets elected twice, and he becomes the great communicator. And I would have liked to have seen what would have happened if Republicans had nominated Marco Rubio. Would the left have called him a fascist? Like, I'm not the left, but like, would the media have decided to like go after someone as ironic and eloquent as Rubio and try to take him down as a racist or a homophobe? Well, and if they did, I might have been red-pilled or woke, whatever word we're using. Like, that might have convinced me that there's no conservative smart enough, good enough, eloquent enough, nice enough to actually win in this era. But we didn't get that chance to test that out.
If Rubio was the nominee, he would be criticized for things. He wouldn't be
sure, that's
different. With the rose petals on his feet and see the entire election. It wouldn't be like Trump, because he's certainly not Trump. I don't know. I mean, you know, he said some unscientific things about climate change. He would be pilloried for that because he was saying things that were not based in science. And maybe some of the rhetoric might be a little heated around that, the way it was for Mitt Romney talking about self-deportation, for example. But Romney says for self-deportation, so he's open to criticism for doing things like that. And you could say Biden's full of women, you know, maybe a clunky comment shouldn't have been overinterpreted, but he still said it. He
tried to hire women. He was trying to hire women.
But he was representing a conservatism that hardly is promoting a lot of other women's rights policies. And so a comment that, like that is going to get interpreted in the broader context of the platform that you're running on.
I still, to this day, Bill, do not understand what the attack was about Binders Full of Women. He said, I was trying to hire somebody, and I asked, you know, in other words,
it's along the lines of, my best friend is a woman. My best friend is black. Therefore, anything you say about me that calls me a racist or sexist shouldn't count. Now there's a whole debate, and I know you went to Nikki Haley before we end here. You know, there's a whole debate, like, you know, who can claim the mantle of feminism? You know, can you be a feminist and be anti-abortion, for example? That debate's been going on for a long time. But obviously, from the perspective of someone on the left who says, look, you can't be a feminist unless you are allowing women to make fundamental choices about their lives, whether they're going to be mothers, when and if they're going to be mothers. someone like Romney come in and saying, "Oh, I love women. I interviewed a lot of women for jobs. Therefore, you can't call me a sexist." You know,
I'd like to go back to the context of when that came up. I think it was, I don't know. I think the context would matter a lot. It was in a debate, I think.
I forget what the question was, but it was in one of the debates.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that would matter a lot. But anyway, that's where I am. And I'm just telling you, like, I want to be clear about this. What I've tried to do here today is be the interpreter, the Trump the bill whisperer, I guess, in this case. Like, having read Michael Malice's book, The New Right, having interviewed him twice, and then having read a lot about this Sarah Bomari, David French battle, this is the state of, you know, I don't even say the right, like, conservatism today. I think the things that I've brought up are pretty mainstream fears and concerns and thoughts that a lot of conservatives have today.
So before we wrap, Nikki Haley's got a new book out. I know you've written about her. Some see her as the successor to Trump whenever the Trump presidency ends. What's your general take on her potential?
Look, I think she's probably overrated based on the fact that, how do you stay relevant for 5 years when you don't have a political office, and when you're walking this really weird line between, she can't criticize Trump, obviously. I mean, she can do it very selectively and strategically, as she has, and she's been brilliant so far. I just don't know if you can do it for 5 more years. You can't really lose Trump or Trump's base completely. I mean, there's some Trumpians who will never trust her because she was a Rubio person, but you can't alienate Trump and Trump's people. But simultaneously, she needs to be the candidate of people like me. But that's hard when she's going out praising Jared Kushner, praising Diamond and Silk, and Charlie Kirk. And so I think that she's almost in this very weird situation where she has to walk this very delicate line and do this delicate dance and stay relevant without, currently at least, we'll see what happens, without an actual position. I think it's a very difficult challenge for her. And think about who was on top 5 years ago, and to try to extrapolate, is she going to be able to pull it off? 5 years is a long time, Bill.
Well, we don't know. We don't know if Trump's winning again or not. I mean, that's a huge factor.
If he loses, it's good for her, right? If he wins,
well,
it's
to your point, she's trying to straddle the Republican establishment, the old Republican establishment, and the Trumpian constituency in the moment. And if being associated with Trump, it becomes a negative upon a loss, maybe those flirtations are damaging, or maybe they're easily shed because she hasn't fully gone over.
Yeah, I think she's better off if Trump loses than if Trump wins. And I would say her chances of being the nominee are much better if Trump loses than if Trump wins. But I'm kind of operating on the assumption that Trump's going to win. So
really,
I think so. I mean, look. I mean, if I had to bet, I would bet.
I mean, there are a lot of Sacramento drag queens out there that are going to scare the middle of the country. So, you know, who knows?
Our nation can't go abroad fighting every drag queen reading hour.
I mean, we talked about this, I think, in a past show, but it comes up again today. Since there's this debate within elite conservative circles about what the direction of the party and the movement should go, and how hard they should fight. If there is this huge constituency that says we're in this fierce war against an unhinged and dangerous left, a Trump loss would not change one's mindset. You wouldn't say, well, I guess we should modulate now because that election didn't work out for us. You would go maximize your arsenal for the next fight, and hopefully you would win then. And so, if that's the direction the party goes, and that's also not good for Nikki Haley. I mean, as much as she's trying to keep nice with the Trump wing, she's never going to be the fiercest culture warrior out there.
Well, part of my concern is that she's got to, 5 years is a long time to sort of hang around, you know, and without a position and try to like stay relevant. And one of the ways to stay relevant is to say controversial things about the news, but you can't really do that except for in very smart strategic moments. So if Trump loses, then the re-election or the 2024 election begins immediately. So she can automatically have a raison d'etre.
Yeah, but I mean,
and so I think that helps her. But the other thing is, Bill, look, she'll be able to argue two things. One, I'm Trumpy enough. And two, we need someone who can win suburban women. If we're going to win the culture war, we need to get elected. I'm the one who can actually do it because I can appeal. So I'm not saying it would work, but I think she would have a pretty cogent argument to make if Trump loses. I think it's harder if Trump wins, because if Trump wins, it means that Trump's style is a winning formula, and it also means she has to bide her time longer before she can really, you know, probably after the mid, you know, around the midterms before people start jockeying for position. Anyway, that's
well,
my take.
Well, you know, even if Trump wins, second terms are not always good for the incumbent party. You know, we didn't follow George W. Bush with another George W. Bush type person, because by the end of the 8 years, he was considered to be very bad. Even in that circumstance, it's possible that this might be crazy to think about. People might tire of Trump after an 8 year stretch and want to go in a slightly different direction.
Yes, that's possible, but I think that. Well, it would be especially possible if Trump either fixed things or if things fixed themselves. But I think that more likely the desire for the opposite of Trump would come from the other party. The party in power might want to keep playing a winning hand, so to speak.
They well might, absolutely. All right. What do you got to plug?
I have a video podcast coming out with Christina Hoff Summers and Danielle Crittenden. That is coming out soon. That I'm pretty stoked about. We get into like all sorts of stuff about feminism and men's rights and the cancel culture stuff. So that should be pretty stellar. Stay tuned for that. Yeah, and you know, listen to us, Matt Lewis and the News on iTunes, and now you can watch it on YouTube. So,
and be on the lookout for this Politico piece I'm writing about Bernie's foreign policy, which is not yet done, and perhaps my editors hate it and never sees the light of day, but I am working hard on it. Hopefully, it will be up soon.
Awesome. Another stellar show. I keep using the word stellar.
Well, there's no better word to describe us, Matt Lewis.
Epic, maybe, but yeah, it's pretty good.
Till next week.
All right. See you guys.
Bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.